You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Thanks for tuning in. This show originally aired on January 28th, 2015, and is archived at weatherbeard.com/Ruthie, R-U-T-H-Y. I want to give a big thank you to Alex Jarrett for all his technical assistance and emotional support to help me get this show on the air and on the computer. Have you ever wondered what it might be like to go for a walk and end up in California? For most of the hour today, we'll be hearing from Annie Keithline, who lives in Northampton, is 25 years old, and walked across the country a few years ago. Annie is currently taking classes part-time, makes vegan sushi at the Winter Farmers Market, and guides seasonal walking ghost tours of Northampton.
So tell me about this walk you went on.
Oh, yeah. So I decided to go walking around, like, when I was 20 or 21. Then I spent, like, 2 years, like, thinking about trying to do it. Because it was very intimidating, because I'd never really done anything like that before. Although I did, one time I biked from Boston to the Cape Cod. So that was, like, kind of a precursor. And then also I used to walk from Amherst to Mount Holyoke, which is, like, 14 miles. But that was also very empowering, because I was like, oh, my gosh, like, I just went so far, and, like, the geography noticeably changes from Amherst to Mount Holyoke. It's like different ecosystems. So it's really cool to go through all the gradients of that. And so I thought that it was something that I'd like to do. I didn't know if I could like afford it or survive during it. But then it turned out to be okay. Oh, and also a few months before I left for mine, I ended up going on a walk with the Nippon Zen Myohoji monks from the Lever Peace Pagoda that February, and we did like 250 miles in New England. So I got to see how they did it. And I mean, they had different resources than I had. Like, they had a lot of people with them. They had a lot of friends along the way already that they could know and stop with. And also they had a car, like a support vehicle, so that it was different. But at the same time, like, I saw, oh, people do this. Some of them have walked across the United States by themselves. Anyway, then I did it, and it was cool.
So, a big question that people always seem to want to know is about the logistics. Like, where did you stay at night?
Yeah. Most of the time, I just stayed outside. Probably, like, 80 or 90% of the time I was sleeping outside. Until about... Until Oklahoma, I actually didn't have a tent.
Wait, what?
Until I got to Oklahoma.
Okay. Did you start in Massachusetts?
Yeah, Amherst? I started in Amherst. I grew up in Rhode Island, but I was working in Amherst at Simple Gifts Farm. So I left there in March of 2012, just walked out of their driveway, and...
With a backpack, or...?
I had a big stroller. I had so much stuff. I had way too much stuff. Like, it was ridiculous. Like, I walked... It was so embarrassing, actually, because I walked, like, 300 yards or something, and I was like, this isn't gonna work. So I actually stopped and, like, just put a bunch of stuff on the ground and kept going. I walked from Simple Gifts to the elementary school at UMass, went up to the door of the elementary school, and left it at the door of the elementary school. And, like, kept going. It was so embarrassing. And then I walked to Northampton, so that was, like, 10 miles the first day. And, yeah, and that was the first night. And then I walked out. I walked through, like, Goshen, the hill towns. I walked to Plainfield, spent a couple days at Earth Dance. And then I walked to Albany, and then I walked to New York City. And then I was like, okay, I guess this is working out. Like, that was the first 100 miles. Like, it's going good. So then I walked down to Florida, and then I went to California. And it's very different walking in different parts of the United States. Like, it's really different walking in the East from the South and the West. And actually, no, the East and the West are more similar because there's much denser population. And, like, also the police are, like, really on edge. Like, you can't walk on the highways in the East or the West, but you can walk on the highways in the South in the middle of the country.
Highways meaning the interstates?
Yeah.
So you said you had a stroller.
It was the kind of stroller, like, it didn't come with a seat on it for the baby. It was the kind of stroller that's actually designed for you to put the car seat onto it. Like, you clip a car seat onto it. It's for people who have two or three kids who want to clip two or three babies on it. So it's kind of just like a platform that you push. And then I put Tupperware containers on it. And so I just filled that up with all this stuff that I thought I was going to need, like, books and journals and, like, big winter boots, even though it's March already, and, like, just all these coats and, like, even a dress I put in there. I don't know, just all this crazy stuff. A radio and a tape recorder and like all these cassettes, like all my Smiths cassettes and like all Morrissey's solo work. And it was just really like I got rid of like also cooking pots and like a camp stove. And the cooking pots I got rid of pretty fast, but the camp stove I didn't get rid of until I got to like the Hudson River. Like halfway down the Hudson, I was like, I'm never gonna cook. Like, I have never used the stove in like so long, like 3 weeks. So I just left it with somebody.
So what did you do for food?
I just bought a lot of it at the grocery store. At the beginning, I did a lot of peanut butter and granola. Then I realized like, oh, I don't really need that many calories because I don't burn that many. So I ended up on a vegan diet towards the end of it, like when I got in the desert and stuff, because that vegan food doesn't go bad as fast. Yeah, and then, of course, I just ate whatever people gave to me. So, depending on who I was with, I either ate stuff that we would just eat here, like chicken and potatoes or something, and then when I went to the South, a lot of fried foods. I don't know, all the stereotypical foods you want to imagine. And then some foods I never heard of, like liver mush. When I got to Shelby, North Carolina, this woman was, like, feeding me liver mush. I did meet a lot of people who wanted me to meet their relatives.
Yeah.
So they would either drive me there, or they would say, oh, you know, they live X, like, you should go there when you're passing through X. And I was like, all right. It was really nice to meet families.
Did you run out of money for food, or how did money work?
There were several different sources of money. My parents gave me some money. My grandmother had passed away a few years before, and she had left me some money that I hadn't used. Also, I had saved up several thousand dollars just from working and stuff, because when you live at the farm, you don't have to spend too much money. Also, random people in the United States gave me like $2,000 to $3,000 without me even asking for it, just like over the course of 20 months or so. And that's not even counting all the food and shelter that they gave me. So I think it helped that I was a woman and that I was walking with like a stroller, because people would just drive up and hand me $20 bill and drive away again. Also, there were 5 different people who gave me $100.
Wow.
Just gave it to me. And, you know, they had various reasons. And some of them were like, I'm just giving this to you. And some of them were like, I'm giving this to you because of my daughter who passed away when she was 3 because she had a rare form of childhood cancer. Like, remember her, you know?
Huh.
Yeah, a lot of people have different reasons why they want to give to somebody doing something like that.
So, okay, so did you have a tent? Where did you stay?
Oh, yeah, so I didn't have a tent until, like, Oklahoma. Which was, like, a year and a few months into it. So, like, the first time I just had a tarp. I'd roll up, like, a burrito, basically. And I had a sleeping bag that was, like, very nice and really warm. And then also, if you're on the East Coast, there's so many towns. You can't get away from civilization. So there's a lot of places that you can sleep, like, in back of schools or churches or sometimes just walking by a building and nobody's there. So you're like, all right, I'm just going to sleep on the porch here. And, like, nobody really cares. And then, you know, couch surfing is great. Every once in a while, I'd be passing through a town and the police would actually come up to me and be like, hey, like, we will put you up for the night in this hotel. And I'd be like, okay. Like, it happened a few different times in Louisiana. Because a lot of the churches actually have a deal with the hotels where they're like, oh, you know, if somebody's passing through town, we'll give you a certain amount of money to put them up, and then the police are kind of like the matchmakers.
Do you have any stories about people that offered you hospitality or food that you want to share?
One time I was walking in the, it must have been in Mississippi because it was the Delta, and it was really hot. It was like the middle of the summer, and I didn't have too much water. So I was stressed out, really stressed out, because it was really, really, really hot. And also, like, on the Delta, it's just this very, very long, flat area, and there's not a lot of people there. I didn't think that would be the case. I thought there would be, like, plenty of people there and, like, churches and stuff, because a lot of Mississippi's like that. But no, this is a very agricultural region, and there's not a lot of infrastructure. I was, like, confused once I got there. I was like, oh, this is weird. And, like, at the end of the day, I got to this place where I thought I was going to be able to fill up water. There was a church on my map, but I got there, and there was nothing there. So I was like, oh no, I'm really in trouble. But earlier in the day, I had been walking, and I spent like 2 hours walking towards this bright yellow crop duster airplane that was in the sky. And so I like kept going closer and closer to it. And then, right when I got right underneath it, I waved up at it. Because I was like, oh my gosh, it's so pretty. Like, it's so funny. And the guy let out a plume of white steam to show that he saw me. I was like, oh, he saw me. Like, I was really happy because I hadn't talked to anybody in like 2 days or something. I was like, oh, communication's been made. Then I kept walking, you know, I get thirstier and thirstier and trying to ration my water. It's not working. Like, I just keep drinking it. And then I get to the place where I think I'm going to be able to find shelter and water, and it's not there. And I was like, oh, no, what am I going to do? So I ended up just laying down at, like, 5:30 in the afternoon on this porch of an abandoned old house after, like, going round and around the house trying to see if they had a spigot or something and trying to see if I could get into the house because it was shady in there and nothing was working for me. So I ended up just laying on the porch in the shade and just being like, blah. And, like, having these crazy dreams of, like, water, like, burning. And it was basically, like, all of those montages you see in the movies of Desert Survivor or something. So then, after, like, what seems like an hour or something, I, like, look up, open my eyes, and there's a big man standing over me. Like, an old guy. Maybe not that old. Maybe either he's like sick. He's like 40, but lived really hard and looks 60, or he's like actually 65. I don't know. But he was just standing there, and I was like, "Oh my god!" Like, I was so shocked. And I go, "Oh, like what's going on?" And he's like, "Hi, I'm the crop duster." And I was like, "Oh my god! Like, wow, hi!" And he said, "Yeah, like I saw you, you know." Most people don't wave. Most people give me the finger. So I thought that you were nice. Like, would you like to come to the hangar and stay for the night? And I was like, do you have water there? And he was like, yep. He was like, I'll make you chicken. I'll give you, like, there's a shower. And I was like, let's go. So like, his truck was painted exactly the same as the plane. It was, like, yellow with a blue stripe. So I got inside the truck and we, like, went back. And, oh, I drank so much water and, like, yeah, he made me some chicken, I took a shower, he showed me pictures of his family on Facebook, and then when I was going to leave in the morning, he gave me this big thermos container of water. And I had that I still have that thermos container, it's at my parents' house in Rhode Island. Yeah, his name's Frank.
So how did you deal with the noises of constant traffic, cars going by?
There's nothing you can do. When I got to Florida, I got a better MP3 player thing, so I could have, like, podcasts and stuff. So I would listen to it with a headphone on the ear that was not the traffic side ear, so on my left ear, and then I would leave the radio free to listen to the cars because it's dangerous to not listen to them. So it stinks because you don't want to listen to them because it's so loud and invasive, especially if you're on the interstate. It's so loud. But then again, if you don't listen to them, you're going to get run over. Also, like, the wind from the cars is, like, pushing on you all the time, and it's so, it's, like, overwhelming. It's a whole different thing. I don't know. Yeah, wow, cars are so powerful and crazy. When I got to Washington, D.C., I stayed with some more Nippon Zen Myohoji people who have the temple there. They're the same organization as the Levert monks. I get all inspired when I go visit them because they walk without a lot of stuff. They're the ones that introduced me to Peace Pilgrim and her writings. So I was like, you know what? When I leave D.C., I'm not going to have anything. I'm going to get rid of all my equipment, and I'm also not going to use money after this. So that was, like, a big to-do. And then I met this other guy. And Tarek was like, you should go visit these Buddhist people in West Virginia. And I was like, oh, really? Like, they have a monastery out there or something? He's like, oh, yeah. He's like, they're really cool, like. And he was like, I'm sure they would be glad to meet you, and, like, you can learn something from them. And I was like, oh my gosh, yeah, that sounds really great. Like, and I always wanted to go to West Virginia, so I'll do that. Like, it's right over the border. I'll just get in, get out. It was, like, 100 miles out of the way, but I was like, oh, it's just, you know, it's all about exploration.
Yeah.
Like,
how many days out of the way is 100 miles out of the way?
Like a week. Although it only turned out to be 5 days, because it turns out when you don't have any stuff, you get bored, and so you walk a lot more. And also, it's so cold at night that you're like, what am I doing? I need to get up and warm up. So you walk and walk and walk. So that was, like, my first 5 days without any of this stuff. So it was very uncomfortable. It was really cold. I was hungry all the time. I did meet this amazing woman named Donna. It was very cold. And eventually,
Wait, did you still have your sleeping bag in your tarp at night?
No.
So at night, what were you doing?
So at night, you had to do different things. Every night, I had to improvise. So I remember one night...
All you had were the clothes on your back at this time. Yeah.
And they weren't that many clothes. And it was August, but it would get down to like 50 to 60 at night, which is cold if you're immobile and you don't have any insulation under you. One night I went to this library and they had a playground out in back, and one of the slides was like that kind of plastic slide that has like walls kind of, so the kids can't just like slip out when they go around the curves. Mm-hmm. So I ended up going to the bottom of the slide and then getting one of the mats from like the wood chip area and just laying it over the top of it to make a little cocoon, and it was awful. It was really staticky. That was one of the most staticky nights of my life. And then another night, I found a scrap of linoleum on the ground, and I was like, yes, like, this is my insulation for the night. So I carried it 2 miles, and then I found another school, and I found, like, the west-facing wall of that school that absorbed all the sunlight, and I put the linoleum down. I was wearing this sweatshirt, and I put the linoleum down. I lay down with my back against the wall, and I was just like, oh, and that was really warm. I actually had to take off my sweatshirt in the middle of the night. But, yeah, then I ended up going to this monastery. I walked 15 miles, and then I went onto their road, which was a 10-mile road. It's one of those country roads that just goes forever and just goes to all these little mountain homesteads and doesn't go anywhere else. And so I went 10 miles down the road, and that was their place. And I get there, and, like, it's the middle of the day. I've been walking since, like, 4 in the morning. And I was like, finally, like, I'm here with this huge catharsis. And I go up to the main office, and I'm like, introduce myself. I'm like, and I walked here from Massachusetts, and like, I've just come so far to see you guys. And they're like, you need to leave. And I'm like, what? Like, I was thinking, like, this lady's joking with me. Like, she's just telling me a joke. And like, she's like, no, like, we can't take you. Like, we have all these guests this weekend. You didn't call ahead. Like, the abbot's not here, so we can't clear it with him. You're a stranger. Like, you have to leave. And I was like, can I just have something to eat? And she was like, no. So I was like freaking out. Yeah. I couldn't even take my shoes off. Like, it was really, it was a shock. And I cried.
Yeah,
like
I cried like a baby. Yeah, I totally would.
Because you just, the fact that
I'm exhausted.
Like, yeah, I was exhausted. I didn't eat anything. Like, eventually somebody else there did end up like taking me in where everybody was eating and being like, give me a bowl and being like, okay, like, that's what I eat. But like, I was sitting there outside and like, people saw me crying. Nobody asked like, are you okay or anything like that. But at the same, like, I was also crying because I was just, I felt like an idiot. Like, I told you yesterday, like, I just was a huge reality check, and I was like, it was just the light like turned on, and I was like, you need to readjust the way you're thinking about this walk, because just because you walk 100 miles out of your way doesn't mean that you're cool or good. Like, you're impinging on these people's hospitality. They don't want you around, and now you feel bad because you're rejected, but it's your fault for not arranging this better and like actually bringing something to the table rather than just being like, I'm a walker, take care of me, love me, haha. Like, oh, so I felt like an idiot.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, and I saw above me that endless skyway, I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. And rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me, a voice was a sounding, this land was made for you and me. There was a big high wall there that tried to stop me. The sign was painted, said private property. But on the backside, it didn't say nothing. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust cloud rolling. A voice was chanting as the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
That was Woody Guthrie.
Anyway, I ended up walking back that 10-mile road, although these guys came by in a pickup truck, and I had walked like 25 miles at that point, and I was just so tired, so like these guys came by in a pickup truck, and they were like, where are you going? And I was like, I don't know, and like they brought me back to the main road, and once I was at the main road, I was like, oh, I can go to Donna's house. Mm-hmm. And she was just this amazing lady. She's like 4.5 feet tall, like a very sturdily built lady. Mm-hmm. And she had this amazing garden in the back of her house, like this multi-layered, crazy terraced and like very artistic garden. And she had these bird houses and said like, oh, you know, I bring my shotgun out here and I shoot those big black snakes that try to eat the bird eggs. And really, like, she had this really short, like, bleach blonde hair. And she was a Virginia Democrat. And when I got back to her house, I knocked on her door, and, like, she came to the door, and she had been drinking beer, and her boyfriend was there, who's, he's, like, a 7-foot brown-haired guy, and just, like, really quiet. He's the quiet one, and she's, like, the loud one. Mm-hmm. I was like, Donna, like, she was like, what happened? Like, what did they do to you? And I was like, they just didn't want me. And she was like, I'm gonna go over there, like, tell me what their address is. I'm gonna go over there with a bag of dog poop and set it on fire and leave it on their doorstep. And I was like, no, Donna, no. But then she started talking about, like, Republicans, and, like, she just went on this whole political and social rant, and, like, you could tell she was so frustrated about other people in her community and how they felt politically and stuff. And, like, she was drinking beer after beer, and her boyfriend, who was, like, this huge guy, was just sitting there very calmly and meekly at the end of the bed, like, rubbing her feet while she's going off all this stuff. She knew I was from the north, and so she knew I was probably liberal or more liberal than the people that she knows in her town. So I think she was also doing that to vent about her frustration, also to connect with me. When a walker comes into a town, it kind of sometimes gives people who are, like, oddballs in that town, like, the excuse to be themselves, or, like, say, like, oh, I got this person, like, come over and see her, and, like,
yeah,
connect with the rest of the town. It offers different opportunities for people to be themselves in a way that they're not often allowed to be in the town that they live in.
I really also like the story you told yesterday about walking into North Philadelphia and the guys
with
the bananas.
Oh, the guys with the bananas! So I was, like, looking forward to going to Philadelphia because I've got a lot of friends in Philadelphia who moved there from here. And before I could go where they were, I ended up cutting down into North Philly and, like, going through there. And as soon as I got into the neighborhood, like, people were, I mean, most people didn't even know. Most people didn't, either they didn't care that I was there, or they're just ignoring me or whatever. And then, like, police kept driving up and being like, do you know where you are? And I was like, yeah, I'm just passing through. And it was totally light out, so I didn't mind. And then a lot of people were, like, happy that I was there and, like, asking me questions about walking around and stuff. And then there were these guys who were, like, sitting in this rubble. There were these two men who were sitting in the rubble next to this abandoned building. Like, this big building. I don't think, it wasn't, like, a residential high-rise, but it looked kind of like an abandoned commercial building. It was really tall. And they're, like, sitting out there in front of it on, like, this big block of cement and eating bananas. Mm-hmm. And, like, I walked up to them and we were talking. Or they like, called me over, and so we started talking about stuff. And they gave me a banana and I was eating it with them. And one of the guys just looked at the other and he's like, look at this girl. She's not afraid. Like, she's not afraid of us. And I was like, no, I'm not afraid of you guys. And they were just like, wow. Like, they couldn't believe that. I just wasn't afraid of them. I don't know who they are, like what they usually do, but they're really jolly at that moment eating bananas. After a while, I realized that nobody was ever going to attack me. And it was probably because when you get out of work or whatever, like even if you don't work, if you're just hanging around all day, like what is more trouble? Like actually like finding a victim and beating them up and murdering them and have to dispose of their body parts, like so many people told me was going to happen to me, or just watching TV.
What were your fears or concerns going into it, and how did those, what happened with those?
Well, I mean, as a woman, you are afraid of getting raped or mugged or kidnapped or whatever. I never really let go of that. Like, even that guy Frank that I was talking about, the crop duster guy. He actually did kind of try to hit on me a little bit, but I was just like, no. And then he never tried to do anything again. Like, some people, especially, like, older white men, I ended up having some trouble with. But after a while, you just learn, like, don't hang out with those people. Like, I stopped staying with older white men. But, you know, they never tried anything serious. Like, it was kind of just, like, they would just, like, say something, like, make a suggestion or something like that.
Want to spend some time with me?
Yeah. Just kind of try it out or try it on or something, or, like, just because they feel like they should. I don't know what it is. It was, like, a generational thing. But everybody else was extremely respectful, and I never had any, I never felt threatened. I did feel scared a lot of the time that I was walking, like a lot, because I'm just a very cautious person, and also I have a very hard time dealing with change. And so when you're on a walk like that, like you're always dealing with change. That's like basically all there is. But I feel like that's just more a product of my nature than anything else, and like there weren't that many times when I actually was in serious danger, but there were a lot of times when I perceived that I was in danger, whether or not that was actually the case. A lot more people probably wouldn't have the kind of fear that I had or anxiety or whatever. They're just not part of their personality, I guess.
It's funny because I sort of assumed that you'd have to be kind of fearless to do something like this.
No, you can be as scared as you want.
Well, did it make it hard to sleep at night sometimes?
Yeah. Like when I stayed in the air hangar with Frank.
Oh, yeah.
I actually had, a pocket knife and I like opened it and kept it under my pillow. But then, you know, I passed out because I was, like, hydrated after being dehydrated. So I felt all, like, fat and happy and, like, just passed out. But, yeah, I remember sometimes, like, in my tent, especially if I had to sleep close to where people were. Like, if I had to sleep close to the road or sometimes I would fall asleep in back of a church and, like, people would come for a church service. And so, you know, that's not exactly a situation where I'm afraid of being discovered. But it is a situation where I'm, like, if I'm discovered right now, I'm going to be spending half the night with these people and they're going to be asking me all these questions and like, I'm going to get to know them. I'm going to be having so much fun with them that I'm not going to be able to sleep until like 1 a.m. and then I can't walk. I mean, it's hard to get up early and walk around the way you should. So I would like hide to try to like save my schedule for the next day, which is such a silly idea now that I look back on it. But sometimes I was like, no, I really need to get to X point by X point. There were a lot of adrenaline moments, you know, every day.
Joseph's face was as black as the night, and the pale yellow moon shone in his eyes. His path was marked by the stars in the southern hemisphere, and he walked the length of his days under African skies.
All right, that was a little bit of Paul Simon. Now I'm trying to cue up the thing to continue the interview with Annie about her walk.
So what did you do in terms of getting enough
rest, or did you have injuries or sickness? When did you get sick?
I did get sick. Well, I only got sick two times, and it was food poisoning both times. Mm-hmm. And it was, like, really bad. The first time I was actually in Philadelphia, or just outside of Philadelphia, and this really nice lady had made me chicken kebabs the previous night. But while I was eating them, I was like, oh, like, these aren't fully done. But mm-hmm. what the heck, I'll just eat them anyway. Mm-hmm. Then I got so sick, and I was, like, in the middle of this town, and I remember just going to this church and collapsing behind the hedge. Mm-hmm. And just feeling like I was going to die. And mm-hmm. then I walked another mile or so, and I threw up next to a train station. Mm-hmm. And then I felt a lot better. But I was just so alone. So, so... You're never more alone than when you have food poisoning.
When you're sick.
Yeah. It's just like, oh my God. And the second time I had food poisoning, it wasn't that bad. And then, like, I didn't even get sick at all. I don't think people who exercise a lot get sick that often. And actually, I met another guy who was a walker named Bruce. And he had pretty much walked around the entire border of the United States, and he's in his 60s or maybe even early 70s. But he said that it all has to do with your lymphatic system or something, and like, oh, it like greatly immense, it like augments your immune system to exercise, like your muscles working will help clean out the toxins from between your cells. And like, he had this grand mm-hmm. speech about it, and I was like, all right, that sounds good. Like, mm-hmm. and it was pretty consistent with my knowledge that walking people don't get sick, because the Nippon Zen people never get sick. Peace Pilgrim reported never really getting sick.
Did you have a destination when you left? And how did you know when you were done?
I knew when I was done because 6 months before that, I was like, I'm sick of walking. I'm going to be done when I get to California.
But you kept on for another 6 months.
Yeah.
How come you didn't just be like, I'm through?
No, you can't do that. Okay, so first I was like, all right, I'm just going to walk. I'm going to walk to Albany, and then I'm going to walk to Manhattan. And if I like it, I'm going to keep going. Then I got to Manhattan, I was like, oh yeah, this is good. So, like, I'm going to walk to Florida. And then that happened. And then I was like, all right, like, I'm still having a good time. I'm going to walk to California. Then I got to Louisiana, and I just kind of started to be like, yeah, I don't know about this. Like, at that point, I was actually planning to walk around the border.
Of the United States?
Yeah. Uh-huh. But when I got to Louisiana, I was like, no, I'm just going to do California. Mm-hmm. Then I'll be done. And that's what ended up happening. So
that was another 6 months away. So... Mm-hmm.
I was in Florida in December, and then...
Okay, so you're on the Gulf Coast.
Yeah.
Louisiana, Texas. But it gets cold in
it
Texas,
gets really cold. Yeah.
Arizona during winter.
Yeah. Well, Texas and Arizona was actually the next summer.
Oh, summer.
So once I was near the Gulf of Mexico, it was a lot warmer, mm-hmm. even though it was still pretty cold. Florida mm-hmm. was definitely the coldest. After I was in Florida, actually, I ended up going back up to Georgia, and I stayed there for a month working on this farm. Uh-huh. Ended up walking west, and I was joined by a friend of mine from Rhode Island, and we walked like 100 miles together to Alabama. That was really cold, too. And uh-huh. I felt really bad because she also wasn't used to it, and uh-huh. so, like, she hated it. But she did really, really well, actually. And she had a knee injury, and she, uh-huh. like, just did it. I was so blown away by the fact that she did it. It was crazy. It was awesome. So that was like going through Tuskegee, and we went to Montgomery, and it was really, Alabama's amazing. It was really crazy dealing with like different elevations and different latitudes and different geographical zones, like ecosystems.
Yeah.
And like learning how the weather works in different parts of the country. I really liked that. That was one of my favorite parts.
How much of the walk did you walk with other people?
I walked 100 miles with Svetlana, and then I walked, like, 9 miles? 5 miles with that guy Bruce that I met. Uh-huh. It was telling me about the lymphatic system. And then I walked about 130 miles with a guy I met in Texas who was actually on a bike trip. Yeah, so we walked together and, like, had a really hard time doing it because we had a lot of personality conflicts. I don't know why he wanted to walk with me, but like, so I was like really set in my ways at that point because I had walked farther than he had biked. Because mm-hmm. I had been on the road more than a year, and he had just left Abilene, Texas on his bike like a few days ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I was like, no, this is the way I want to do it. But also, he was a lot faster than me, not just because he had the option of being on a bike, but because he's a guy. And also, I'm just a really slow person in general. Like, I want to do everything really slow. Mm-hmm. I had a whole other mentality, and he wanted to go faster. And so, eventually, he just left.
Yeah.
But it was not an unfriendly departure. And also, yeah. we still keep in touch, and, like, I think of him fondly now and again. And we had some amazing times, because it was New Mexico. And we just discovered, like, these little towns on top of this big mesa. And, like, it was so good to have somebody else with me to, like, see these little towns and, like, the people inside them. And they're very kind communities. And they really were hospitable to us. And they're also extremely peaceful places. And nobody had suspicions about us. They let us sleep, like, right in the middle of town, mm-hmm. in the park, mm-hmm. like, where all the kids play and stuff. Nobody mm-hmm. had any second thoughts about it whatsoever. The long-distance walking thing is really... it's, like, an inspiring thing mm-hmm. for different reasons. And, like, one of the reasons that I wanted to do it... like, there are a lot of competing reasons that I want to do it. And one of them was that all my life I've never really... I've always felt that my personality was just bad, like very wrong, shameful, like that I didn't want to be who I am. And so I felt like, okay, I need to do something that's going to rewrite all this, like something that even when I realize like I'm not the person that I want to be, I can still say, well, you still managed to get this done. You did something. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. It's like a very catalytic thing. To walk a long distance. At least it seemed to me at that time, and I guess it still does. After a while, when you're doing it, you start thinking about it differently because it just becomes so routine. Mm-hmm. And every day, you know, you get up, you pack, you walk really far, you eat, you unpack, you sleep. Like, it's really basic. But with other people, when they see you, they're like, oh my, you just walked 1,500 miles? And mm-hmm. for them, it occurs in the blink of an eye. Mm-hmm. And they're like, it's like you have a superpower because you just walked so far. And it's like, wow, like people just can't get over it. And especially if you're like a girl, mm-hmm. people are freaking out. I don't know how you are, but I project a lot of stuff on Peace Pilgrim mm-hmm. because she's such an inspiring figure. Like, people will give you more credit than you deserve. Mm-hmm. If you're going to walk far, you don't have to be as amazing as Peace Pilgrim for people to give you more credit than you deserve. Like, a couple women, I remember meeting different women different times, and they would say things like, I know you're an angel. Mm-hmm. Like, they would be like, you're actually, like, you must be an angel. Mm-hmm. I'd be like, what? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so nice when that happens because they're looking at you and they have such a happy expression on their faces. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you're like, I'm not an angel. Sometimes I would say I was walking for peace. Sometimes I would say I'm walking to find myself, which is, like, so boring. But I went through a phase where I'd be like, well, I really love the United States. And when you really love somebody, you want to spend all your time with them. By the end of the trip, I was like, I don't know. Because mm-hmm. I was just tired of it. I want to get done. Uh-huh. I'm walking to get to California. Uh-huh. I can go home.
It seems like, to me, like 6 months is a long time to continue with something when you decided you kind of had enough.
Not if you spent the 2 years before you left telling everybody you were going to walk across the United States. Uh-huh. Walking up and down in the United States is not the same thing.
So you had your integrity to defend.
Yes, that was a big motivator. It was useful for me to learn that because now whenever I start a project, in order to avoid flaking out on it, I make sure to tell people for mm-hmm. months before I'm going to mm-hmm. do it that I'm mm-hmm. going to do it.
So you live in Northampton now. How did that walk affect the way you see life or your capabilities now?
I guess I have an easier time not sweating the small stuff. And I exercise a lot more. Mm-hmm. Like, I never used to do cardio because I was always very unfit. Mm-hmm. But when I got to Oklahoma City, I was just so tired of walking. Just doing the same movement and moving mm-hmm. my body forward day mm-hmm. after day after day. And also just, I needed some cardio. I was like, mm-hmm. I need cardio now! Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to run because it was just the same thing, like yeah. going forward straight. Yeah. So I went to the YMCA and I did a spin class. And mm-hmm. it was so fun! I had an amazing mm-hmm. time. Like, I got to see how fast I was going on this little thing on the bike. And mm-hmm. I was going so fast. I was like, oh my god, like, if I had a bike, I could go, like, so many miles a day. So I did cardio then. And then after I came home, I was living with my parents in Rhode Island, and I got a gym membership, and I did spin classes there. And then I actually started running there, which is amazing. Like, I run now. It really has done a lot to keep my mood stable. Like, I always had a lot of problems, especially in the winter, with mm-hmm. mood swings, and it kind of just darkened, like, pretty much the entire first 20, 22 years of my life. Mm-hmm. But now, thanks to learning how to live with exercise as a constant part of my life, I am feeling so much better. Mm-hmm. When you get better, like, you look back and you see how unwell you mm-hmm. were. Mm-hmm. So in that way, the walk has really, really, really changed my life. Also, I came to appreciate a lot of things about Northampton and New England in general that a lot of the country doesn't have. Like, people here are very, very, very highly educated. Also, people up here are very sarcastic, mm-hmm. and I really like that. That New England snark. Also, the food up here is really amazing. Oh, it's not easy to get that good food. Like, people talk about food deserts and stuff. I was in the food deserts. It's most of the United States. Even in Massachusetts. Because, I mean, there's a food desert where, like, you can't get anything but Twinkies and ramen and stuff. But then there's the bigger kind of food desert, which is, like, anybody who doesn't have Red Fire Farm or, like, Crab Apple Farm or Cane Creek Farm or something. Now I just, you know, I'm basically living life and I have work and I went back to college and I got a lot of great food and I'm hanging out with all the wonderful, smart, and funny people in Northampton. And it's really, like, I died and went to heaven.
How do you think your walk affected your, you know, like, your sense of independence, your self-confidence in doing these other ventures?
Oh, well, I have a big safety outlet because if I ever end up screwing up any of these ventures, I know I can just walk out. I just walk out of the house right now and walk to Florida and work at Disney World or something. I think it was good that I spent so much time feeling scared and cold and lonely when I was walking around, because now I know that, like, that doesn't have to happen to me anymore. Mm-hmm. So I just have a better sense of proportion than I did before. You know, when you're in extreme situations, it makes everything else not look that bad.
Yeah. That was my housemate Alex Jarrett playing a waltz on the piano. This has been an interview with Annie Keithline of Northampton. Annie walked across the country a few years ago, and she's been telling us about her walk. Now Annie's selling sushi that she makes at the farmer's market, at the winter market in Northampton.
I was like, well, maybe I'll just have a sushi booth at the farmer's market. I like to make sushi, and I started making vegan sushi. I started watching a lot of documentaries about sushi, trying mm-hmm. to find out how I can make it better. And a lot of the sushi chefs, including some of the more hardcore traditional Japanese sushi chefs, mm-hmm. are very worried about fish and the ecosystems of the ocean. Not only availability, but just what overfishing is doing to the environment. And some people talk about the vanishing of the tuna. Just the whole trend where when apex predators disappear, it spells doom for the rest of the ecosystem. For people who make sushi, this is part of what they have to deal with on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And then I was just thinking about, like, well, you know, I live in Northampton. We're, like, 2 hours from the ocean, south and east. So why use fish at all? You know, unless it's coming from the Connecticut River. And, I mean, I heard the Connecticut River's gotten a lot better, but I don't know if I would eat fish from there yet. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, we do have a great resource here, which is all of our farms, all the fresh produce that we have that mm-hmm. not a lot of other people in the United States have. So I think that local sushi that just uses the gifts of the area is, it's just a fun challenge.
So you make, like, rice and vegetable sushi or what?
Yeah, and I don't get the rice or the seaweed from here yet, but all of the fillings in the sushi are from that market. I show up at the NoHo Winter Farmers Market at the Smith Agricultural and Vocational School, and I set up the stand, get everything ready, and then I basically just go around to the different booths and I see what looks nice, and I go and I try to prepare it with minimal cooking mm-hmm. just to make all the flavors as fresh as possible. I do sometimes blanch harder things like squash or, oh, I had these beautiful beets the other day, the kind with the red and white spirals yeah. inside. Mm-hmm. If you just blanch that for like 30 seconds in mm-hmm. very thin slices, then it looks just like a tuna. I don't get the rice in the seaweed from, you know, around here yet, but I have been going up to visit some rice farmers in Vermont and New Hampshire, trying to source stuff.
You've been listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Out There airs every Wednesday from 4 to 5 on WXOJLP 103.3 FM, valleyfreeradio.org. You can also find archives of Out There at weatherbeard.com/Ruthie, R-U-T-H-Y. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Up at 5 o'clock. Thank you.